You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we find out why encouraging activism among girls might mean getting out of their way. But first, when President-elect Trump assumes office in less than 20 days, he'll inherit more than 100 unfilled federal judge seats throughout the country. Our next guest joins us to talk about why there are so many empty seats and what unique challenges could face President-elect Trump as he appoints judges nationwide, including the highest seat in the land, the Supreme Court. Rick Essenberg joins us now. He's the founder, president, and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Rick, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first off, why are there so many upcoming empty judicial seats?
Well, there are a lot of federal judges, and there's a fair amount of turnover. There are more vacancies coming out of the Obama administration than there were out of the Bush administration, but we've seen a change in the rules. And the rules were actually changed by the Democrats because they didn't want a guy named Miguel Estrada to be confirmed in the D.C. Circuit, and so they essentially blocked his nomination. And so the rules have changed, and we have filibusters for the lower courts, and it becomes, I think, much more difficult to move a nomination. Now, you can look at that two different ways. It certainly does block the ability of an administration to get precisely the judges that it wants, but it also forces compromise. So there have been examples of, you know, the ability to get some judges confirmed if they were judges that both sides could agree on. But the difficulty is, given the movement in the law over the years and differences in our conceptions of what judges should do and how much discretion they should exercise, it has over the long run become more important to know a judge's philosophy as opposed to simply knowing whether she's a really good lawyer or not. And that leads to what look like political conflicts and sometimes difficulty in getting people confirmed.
I've seen the number slightly upwards of 100 as far as the open judgeships that look to be filled during the Donald Trump presidency. How does that compare with what we might have seen during the previous 8 years of Barack Obama's presidency?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to hold me to the numbers, but I think that there was something in the 50s at the end of the Bush administration going into President Obama's first term.
Just by sheer force of numbers, does that mean we're going to be looking at a kind of overhaul of the makeup of the judiciary in the country?
And we always have that every time, you know, the presidency changes. I mean, the federal judiciary looks a lot different today than it did 8 years ago. 8 years ago, probably a majority of the circuit courts of appeals had what you would call a conservative majority. You have to be a little bit careful when you use these terms with judges, but I think it's still nevertheless a fair term to use. Right now, I think an overwhelming majority of the circuit courts of appeals have what you'd call a liberal or progressive majority, and that will probably change back during the Trump administration, although it's a little bit hard to say. You know, Donald Trump has said and made a campaign issue out of the fact that he was going to appoint conservative constitutionalists to the court. I actually think that had he not done that, he would not have won the election. But he himself shows very little evidence of being a conservative constitutionalist. And so I think time will tell whether he actually appoints those types of judges to the federal bench.
Well, and obviously the biggest seat that's open is the Supreme Court seat, filling in the role that was played by Antonin Scalia. What do we know about what kind of justice Donald Trump has said that he's looking for to fill that seat?
Well, he has said that he's going to nominate a conservative constitutionalist. He's given us a list of 21 people that he would consider for that vacancy and promised that he would appoint from that list. So, you know, people like me, you know, people that are in the sort of conservative and libertarian legal movement, really like his list. I mean, we really like people like Don Willett and Diane Sykes and Bill Pryor. And I think that for this vacancy, I think you can expect him to do what he said he would do. I think it would create a great deal of consternation and revolt among the Republicans if he departed from that, and I think would jeopardize things that, you know, to be honest, he may care more about than the Supreme Court vacancy.
Now, Scalia was, as I understand it, an originalist, someone who looked to the original intent of the writers of the Constitution. You're talking about a constitutionalist. How would you compare those two terms?
Well, I mean, I think I'm sort of using the same term, right? The idea is that to what extent does a judge believe that he or she can find some contemporary legal meaning in the Constitution, and how do you go about doing that? So on the one side, you have people who sort of emphasize what's sometimes called textualism, which basically is a fancy word to say that, well, you know, we're going to give constitutional provisions the meaning that the language suggests, that we're going to read it as it was written. But language is not always precise, and sometimes you have to try to resolve ambiguities. And an originalist would, and there are various forms of originalism, but would believe that what you really need to do is you need to get at the original public meaning of this provision, that because we use constitutional provisions to restrain what our democracy can do, we declare laws of Congress unconstitutional, acts of the president unconstitutional. In order for that to be legitimate, we have to be enforcing a legal principle that at some point in our past we democratically adopted. And the only way really to limit yourself to doing that is to try to ascertain this sort of original public meaning. Now, that doesn't mean that a principle can't be applied to new circumstances. So, for example, we have the Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures, and you know, we have to ask ourselves whether forms of technological surveillance that didn't exist at the time the Fourth Amendment was adopted nevertheless constitute a search and seizure. But we can still attempt, insofar as possible, to apply this original principle that was that we adopted at some point in our history.
And, Rick, as we wrap up, Democrats have said that the amount of obstruction from Republicans in confirming President Obama's picks was unprecedented. How much power do Democrats in the Senate have to block or at least make very difficult the confirmation of Donald Trump's picks?
Well, they have some. They've given up some of it in the sense that, you know, they went to the nuclear option on lower court judges. You know, I think one of the things that we've seen happen, and it's unfortunate over the past 8 years, is that particularly in the Senate, senators have, you have to sort of lay the blame on the Democrats for this because they were the ones who held the White House, that senators have become less concerned with the Senate as an institution and seen it more as a way to facilitate whatever the executive wants. And so the real question that we are going to have going forward is, now that the Republicans have the White House and control the Senate, are the senators, the Republican senators, going to see themselves in that way? Are they going to see their role as facilitating what President-elect Trump wants, or are they going to see themselves as preserving the privileges and the prerogatives of the Senate as an institution?
Rick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Rick Essenberg is the founder, president, and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. He joined us to talk about the more than 100 open judicial seats that President-elect Donald Trump will inherit when he takes office in just a couple of weeks. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll look at the presidential transition as Washington prepares for President-elect Donald Trump to take office. First, a look at the new face of activism among girls. Our guest makes a case that activism is good for not just girls, but also for schools and the wider community. But she says it's important that older women, teachers, parents, and mentors know how to support girls in their activism. Lynn Michael Brown joined us recently. She's professor of education and the director of women's gender and sexuality studies at Colby College in Maine. She's also co-founder of three grassroots organizations, the Spark Movement, Powered by Girl, and Hardy Girls Healthy Women. Her new book is Powered by Girl, a guide for supporting youth activists. Lynn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, and a big part of the reason that you wrote this book is the concern that the idea and the experience of girl power, girl activism is being commodified. And it's also being driven by this notion of sort of the single exceptional girl. What do you see happening here?
Yeah, I mean, I've been noticing this not only because of the work I've done with girl activists. You mentioned the 17 Action and the Google Action. Those were accomplished by a group of girls working with adult allies and a lot of partner organizations to do that work. And we noticed over and over again that the way media sort of, you know, talked about these issues were to kind of pick out one girl and to really highlight her story and her specialness and her kind of uniqueness. And it sort of, it was really frustrating. In fact, Julia Bloom, who did the 17 magazine, stopped talking to media unless they would acknowledge that this was a collective coalition, you know, doing the work. And she started talking about media as photoshopping the action in the way that they, you know, photoshop girls' images, but just sort of focusing on the one girl, which really doesn't tell the full story. And by not telling the full story, it really doesn't give the girls listening or watching the information they need to do the same kind of work.
Why do you think that's happening? Why is there a temptation for the media to just pluck out this one single girl from a team of other activists and supporters and just shine a spotlight on her?
Yeah, I just think it makes a compelling story, right? And they're often, you know, young girls. I mean, Marley Diaz, who did sort of the 1,000 Black Girl Books action, was, I think, 11. You know, Julia was 13. Rachel Parent, who did work on GMOs, started when she was 8. And I just think that's a really compelling story. These young girls who seem to, like, have it all together and be just so incredibly accomplished. And, you know, that's a unique story. It's not such a great story to say that they worked with adults, that they worked with a coalition of partner organizations. And in reality, that makes them really savvy activists because that's how you get stuff done. But it doesn't make for the same kind of story.
And there is sometimes a generational difference when younger women and older women relate to each other. And when we're talking about these communities around activists, you say that it is really important that these young women are supported and that there is this intergenerational play that goes on. How do you suggest that happens, that older women and young activists work together?
Well, I think older women, I include myself, really have to appreciate the fact that girls are experts on their own experience, that their experiences now are very different than ours growing up. And so in order to do this work, we have to be able to listen. We have to be humble. And we have to, you know, allow them to sort of take the lead. I mean, I see our role as adults as sort of scaffolding, you know, in the way that a building is scaffolded. So you provide support as needed, but the hope is that the girl will, and the group of girls will sort of be able to kind of lead the project forward. And some of that support falls away and when they're ready. So it's not that, you know, girls don't lead and don't do amazing things, but nobody does social change work on their own, not really effective change work.
You've said that right now the stars are sort of aligning for young feminists. Why do you think this is a good time to be a young feminist?
Well, their pop stars are claiming feminism and they're claiming activism, and girls are seeing this everywhere. You know, there's a lot of sexism in the air right now and racism, and I think a lot of issues that really compel girls, and they really want to be part of making the world a better place, making it the kind of world they really want to live in. And so I think there is a lot of energy, and that's my experience working with girls, is they are so ready to do this work, but they just are not getting the information about how to connect and how to sort of work in coalition and how to build actions together.
Do you think that's different from other generations that might have also had this sort of upsurge of young feminists?
I think it's, you know, it's similar in some ways, and I think back to the Riot Girl movement in the 90s, where young women were sort of joining punk bands and writing fanzines and really pushing back on sexual violence and sexism and reclaiming the word girl to be a power word. You know, and that work, too, got kind of commodified and, you know, became Spice Girls, became, you know, girl power products for, you know, a generation. And so I feel I get concerned when girl activism gets commodified in a similar way, because I feel like if it's going to be driven by the market, it's going to be driven by the lowest common denominator, and it's going to be non-threatening. And the way these girls are written about in media is very, you know, they're very smiley and non-threatening. And in fact, they're very, in real life, angry about things and assertive and, you know, willing to sort of take risks. But that's really not the story that gets told.
We're talking with Lynn Michael Brown right now from Colby College in Maine, talking about her book, Powered by Girl, a Field Guide for Supporting Youth Activists. And you just used the word angry. And that's something that, you know, historically women were not supposed to be. Do you think that in this new world of girl activism, there's a place for being outspoken and loud and, yeah, maybe angry too?
Yeah, I do. And I think, you know, psychologists and philosophers, if you look at the literature, you know, really talk about anger as a political emotion, you know, that you really need to identify what it is you feel strongly about in order to sort of be motivated to do social change work. I think that's always been the case, but I think there's right now a real liveliness about and a real openness about girls' voices and strong feelings, and it feels like it's a moment of incredible potential.
Do you think that has to come from within the activist community, that sense that it is okay to be loud and angry and have ideas and, you know, be some things that girls historically were not supposed to be? Or is it something that the broader culture has to support, you know, at least in tandem?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's important for girls to sort of be part of coalitions who really can support their strong feelings about an issue. I mean, a coalition is a group of people working across difference who have a real similar goal in mind. And for girls to be part of that, it makes them feel like their strong feelings and their risk-taking, their anger is, you know, it's supported. They have company, and that's really important. I think it's more important than having sort of being able to please people, you know, outside of the group or whatever, or to have sort of the broader cultural, the culture be supportive, I think.
Now, you yourself, you founded three of these girl-powered grassroots organizations. One is Spark, there is Hardy Girls, Healthy Women, and Powered by Girl 2. What do you do in these groups that you think is getting at this activism in the right way?
Well, I think what we do is we bring girls together, again, across difference. It's really important for girls to sort of get to know and experience different perspectives. I mean, you know, and I'm talking about racial difference and gender nonconformity and just really having girls have the experience of different voices, different people working on the same cause. And I think it having adults who are really loyal to them, you know, who are willing to build genuine relationships. And when the going gets tough, they really stand with girls. And, you know, a lot of girls have experiences growing up of, you know, adult betrayal, you know, of sort of people who say they're there and when push comes to shove, they're not. I think it's also, you know, offering girls, you know, a sense of, you know, coalition, as I said, and really respecting their knowledge and their expertise and what they bring to these issues. So I think in our groups, we really try to be honest and genuine in our thoughts and feelings. And, you know, sometimes girls are challenging us, you know, challenging us because of the compromises we've made as adult women. And we have to stay in that and stay in those conversations. And I think that's kind of a unique experience for girls. They just don't have that opportunity very often with women.
What kind of things do they challenge you on?
They challenge us on our, you know, definition of feminism. I mean, I've been pushed over the years to really understand, you know, intersectionality and, you know, gender nonconformity and trans issues. And, you know, I've learned a ton by just being with girls, working with girls, engaging with them, you know, arguing with them. And, you know, they, you know, my daughter as well, who's been in some of these organizations, has, you know, really pushed me to think about, you know, how I understand the work I'm doing. So I think that when they push us at the very heart of the matter, that's the tough stuff, and that's when we really have to stay present.
Are we talking about an extended activist, you know, family of just other women, or are we talking about men and women?
Yeah, I think we're talking about men and women. I think we're talking about adults and youth. I mean, I work primarily with girls and women who are working with girls in the nonprofits I've developed and organizations. But I absolutely think this has to be, you know, we're all in this, right? I mean, we all have to be working on sort of making the world a more just and caring place.
Do you think what you're talking about could be seen as sort of a counterbalance to what some people like the writer Peggy Orenstein has called the pornification of society, sort of this excessive focus on sexuality, especially for girls?
Yeah, I think it's so key, and I love Peggy's work, and I feel like, you know, there was this really interesting study a few years back by a psychologist, and the title was Objects Don't Object. You know, and it was about sort of evidence showing that self-objectification sort of disrupts women's social activism. You know, if we're seeing ourselves as objects, we tend to be kind of more passive. And so I think absolutely this kind of work of really engaging girls in, you know, critical thinking and looking beneath the surface of things and really challenging the descriptions and stereotypes and constructs is a way to kind of, you know, challenge and push back that is absolutely necessary for girls to be healthy in this culture, I think, especially the culture of sexualization.
And Lynn, before we let you go, what is your hope for the future of girl-powered activism?
My hope is that a lot more adults get involved in this, and that particularly a lot more schools and teachers get involved. Because I feel like, you know, when girls and boys are really, you know, identifying the places that they're hurt and identifying the places that they feel are unjust, and they have adults engaging with them on making those changes, we can really make our schools and communities better places.
Lynn, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That was Lynn Michael Brown, Professor of Education and Director of Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Quilby College in Maine. She's the author of Powered by Girl. Coming up, we'll learn about the presidential transition as the Trump administration gets ready for the White House. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight at 7, it's Reveal. Tonight, Reveal revisits stories that listeners said were the most memorable. First, President Barack Obama and President-elect Donald Trump met a couple of days after Trump won the election to talk about the transition between their administrations. During a press conference after that meeting, President Obama said this.
As I said last night, my number one priority in the coming 2 months is to try to facilitate a transition that ensures our president-elect is successful.
But in the weeks since that meeting, President-elect Trump has sent out many tweets showing different stances from President Obama, and the president has been making resolutions and executive actions to try to protect his legacy. The New York Times has characterized the current state of the presidential transition as, quote, dueling administrations. Lily Gorin joins us now in our Milwaukee studios to talk about the presidential transition. She is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Happy New Year.
You too.
Thanks.
Well, Lily, what do you think about the New York Times wording there, that this is dueling administrations that we're seeing here?
Well, you know, you do have, obviously, a transition from one partisan administration, from the Obama administration, Democrats, to a Republican administration led by Trump. And we saw that going on also in 2008 and into 2009 when Obama, as a Democrat, took over from George W. Bush, who was a Republican. We also saw that, obviously, in 2000 when George W. Bush took over as a Republican from Bill Clinton, who was a Democrat. And so we do have, again, a tradition in this country going all the way back to the beginning of the Republic in terms of the constitutional system, where the sort of transition of power from one party to another, famously the election of Thomas Jefferson in 1800, who was of a different sort of political ideology and ultimately party from John Adams, who had preceded him.
It seems as though in this time before President-elect Donald Trump takes office, that President Obama, in his waning days in office, has been pretty busy. He's banned oil drilling off the Atlantic coast, protected funding for Planned Parenthood, punished Russia for the supposed cyber attacks as well. Is it normal for the outgoing president to be doing this much?
Well, presidents, as they're leaving, often, you know, try to sort of finish off policy areas that they are committed to. And so you see that going on in terms of this particular transition. If you think back to 2008, what we saw going on at that time was, of course, the financial crisis and really the economy kind of imploding. And so you had a more of a crisis situation in the last transition period and one where, you know, the Bush administration was also working with Congress, which at that point had a Democratic House, to try to staunch some of the, you know, sort of some of the crisis, the economic crisis, since you do have less of a crisis situation now. And so a lot of the policies that Obama has been sort of trying to implement throughout his administration, he's trying to sort of finish off and possibly protect them, as you noted, from possibly unraveling quickly come the Trump administration and also the Republican majorities in the House and the Senate.
Do any of the actions that President Obama has taken in the last couple weeks strike you as anything that's remarkable or noteworthy as he prepares to leave office?
I mean, I don't think that there's anything remarkable or necessarily noteworthy with regard to, you know, some of the sort of areas that he has been trying to, again, protect in terms of what he has advocated for and pushed through in terms of policy over his 8 years in the Oval Office. I do think, you know, we haven't heard any pardons yet, in terms of usually presidents, these in the contemporary period, presidents make sort of final pardons right before they leave office, and so there may be a couple of pardons or not coming in the next couple of weeks. Sometimes those are controversial.
And President Obama, his approval rating is pretty high right now. He's going out on a high note where it seems as though Donald Trump is coming in at a lower point than President Obama. Does that, do you think, have anything to do with the shape that this transition is taking?
Well, I mean, this is sort of, again, coming out of the campaign season itself and the election, when Trump did not necessarily have high approval ratings throughout. And, you know, it was one of the issues that neither he nor Hillary Clinton had very high approval ratings, whereas Obama's approval ratings continued to sort of move up during the election season, and ultimately they've continued in that direction as he's leaving office. He's leaving office with some of the highest approval ratings of a contemporary president.
Why do you think that is, that he's sailing out on a high note like that?
I guess it's, you know, to some degree, again, sort of the waning days of an administration. Oftentimes, unless there's some sort of a crisis, people sort of look back and sort of perhaps wistfully and sort of say, oh, you know, he did a good job. Maybe I don't agree with him, but, you know, he sort of came in and this is what he said he was going to do. Or for people who do agree with him, sort of said, well, look at all the things that he's accomplished.
And so you're saying we've seen this with other presidents that are outgoing.
You do sort of see, again, unless there's some other issue that's sort of impacting the exit of the president, because, you know, 8 years ago, I compare it to George W. Bush when he exited office during the financial crisis. His approval ratings were quite low. And a lot of that was, again, tied up and around with regard to his to what was going on economically and to some degree the impact that he was having or the difficulty that, you know, the country in general was going through at the time. And the other thing that sort of does sometimes happen is presidents, after they leave office, will often have a period of time when, after they've left, that their reputations will be revisited and they will have higher sort of approval ratings or they'll have higher endorsements after they leave office and they've been out of office. You know, George W. Bush's approval ratings have gone up substantially since he left office.
We're talking with Lily Gorin right now. She's in our Milwaukee studios and we're talking about the presidential transition. Lily is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University. And one thing that does seem different in this transition than in the past is the tweeting of Donald Trump. Last week, President-elect Trump tweeted, "Doing my best to disregard the many inflammatory President O statements and roadblocks." This was, or he said, "thought it was going to be a smooth transition, dash, not, exclamation point." And then President Obama called him up and they spoke. And then Trump reversed a little bit what he had to say. Here's what he said.
"Our staffs are getting along very well, and I'm getting along very well with him, other than a couple of statements that I responded to, and we talked about it and smiled about it. And nobody's ever going to know because we're never going to be going against each other in that way. So, but he was, it was a great conversation."
So there's a kind of back and forth like that, but half of it is happening, some of it is happening very publicly on Twitter in a way that we really haven't seen before. Is that affecting the way the transition is unspooling, or is this, you know, the Twitter is just the medium, but the message would have been the same anyway?
Well, I mean, I think what you're seeing in general with regard to the Trump transition is that it's not necessarily from the perspective of somebody who explores the presidency, it's not necessarily been the smoothest transition period. Most of the time, presidents-elect often come in with a list of people who they expect to appoint to their cabinet, and what we've seen with regard to Trump is it's not only does he have, you know, sort of a variety of people, but he hasn't necessarily chosen which person he would like to appoint. And we saw this in particular with regard to the position for Secretary of State, where he was talking to a number of people, including Mitt Romney, about that position, and then ultimately indicated Rex Tillerson. But there, you know, sort of a lot of back and forth publicly. That's generally not the case with regard to presidential transitions. There may be more of that behind the scene with people sort of speaking to the president-elect and sort of vetting of the individuals before they're publicly indicated as the nominee for a cabinet post. But it's not usually sort of a number of people in public indicated as a possibility. And so I think between a lot of the tweeting that Trump and his and his surrogates and his spokespeople have been doing, as well as the way he's, you know, sort of talking to a number of people for a variety of posts within the administration, that it hasn't been necessarily the smoothest of transitions.
We're talking right now to political scientist Lily Gorin, talking about the presidential transition. And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you think the presidential transition is going so far? Do you think that President Obama is overreaching with some of his current actions, or do you wish that he were going further? And do you think that President-elect Donald Trump is speaking up too much, maybe on Twitter, in the time before he officially takes office? You can call us now at 800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our discussion now about the presidential transition with Lily Gorin from Carroll University. And we're taking your calls right now at 800-642-1234. What do you make of these seemingly dueling administrations? What executive actions would you like to see President Obama put into place before President-elect Donald Trump takes office? And what do you think of President-elect Trump as he gears up to become president, about his actions so far in the lead-up? Call in at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take our first caller now. We have Elaine with us in Colfax. Elaine, hi.
Hi. I think that Donald Trump is acting quite juvenile, and it's really undignified using Twitter and just, he's very reckless and childish. I think it reveals how inept and, you know, how unprepared he is for this job. And I think that President Obama has every right to protect his legacy, to continue working until the last day as president.
Elaine, thank you for your comments there. Elaine saying Trump's use of Twitter is undignified and reckless. And those adjectives aside, is there anything breaking of norms in this behavior when it comes to a clear delineation of who is commander-in-chief of the United States and that there can only be one president at a time? Is there sort of a blurring of boundaries at all?
Well, this is essentially the first time we've seen the use of Twitter in this regard. In 2008, neither the McCain nor the Obama team was really using Twitter in the way that Donald Trump or his campaign have been using it. And so in terms of the use of it and in the way that it's being used by Trump and his campaign, it certainly is not the norm, but again, it's a sort of new media environment, and he's used Twitter in this regard throughout the entirety of his campaign, both for the nomination and ultimately for the general election. And so he's just continuing to some degree his use of Twitter in that regard. You know, it's hard to say, is it, you know, sort of reckless and childish. I believe it was Jeb Bush who said of Trump while he was running against him that Trump was kind of a chaos candidate. And that, you know, the use of Twitter and possibly dueling tweets from Trump, you know, sort of saying one thing in the morning, possibly, and then another thing in the evening, is how he got some of that reputation from people who were running against him. But again, it's also the way he's using the medium itself, Twitter, that is novel in general.
Elaine, thanks a lot for the call. And we go next to Tim in La Crosse. Tim, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
It seems like Obama's just kind of troublemaking on the way out. Look at the red line in the sand. You know, there's all kinds of things that he didn't do. What about the Russia and the email or the hacking? Supposedly that was a big nothing, but now all of a sudden it's a problem. He's just making trouble on his way out the door is all he's doing.
Tim, thank you for that comment. And Tim, echoing what, you know, other Republicans, I don't know if Tim's a Republican, but what some Republicans have said, that Obama is trying to kind of stir up the mud puddle, make things, put in place some speed bumps or hurdles for Trump, who he'll be entering and trying to get things done.
And in that regard, you know, it certainly is what presidents do as they, you know, they're concluding their administration. It's not necessarily different in the Obama administration than it was in previous administrations as they're leaving office, particularly if there's, you know, a different party coming in. And that's part of the difference. We haven't seen a transition from one party to another since 1988. And so, you know, since the transition from George H.W. Bush to Clinton, every transition in power has been from one party to another. And at the very end, most of the presidents, as they're concluding their administration, are in fact trying to maintain their policies.
We mentioned the Twitter account, and Donald Trump has been tweeting also about foreign policy, about maybe building up a nuclear arsenal, and he also commented on China taking a Navy drone. Lily, do you think this affects U.S. foreign policy when there is a clear break between one administration and another in terms of stances?
Well, I mean, this is some of the, you know, sort of perplexing parts of this transition period. It's not only the drone, the water drone, and so forth, but you've seen the telephone call with regard to Taiwan, and again, sort of different policy approaches with regard to Russia, both from the Obama administration as well as members of Congress and the incoming Trump administration. And so you have a variety of different sort of voices on foreign policy issues, some of them, again, in the same party as Trump, but with regard to different sort of approaches to, you know, how our policy has been and should possibly continue with regard to, say, Russia, or how it might change.
We're talking with Lily Gorin right now from Carroll University, taking stock of the presidential transition. And Lily, in terms of how much one outgoing president can affect or influence and also, you know, just sort of help smooth things for the next person coming in, do you think that what we're seeing here is typical, or would you not expect to see a lot of kind of hand-holding as one president goes out and another comes in?
Well, what usually happens, again, is oftentimes more behind the scenes. And I wouldn't say it was necessarily hand-holding, but it's, you know, it's sort of coming in as a new president. You are going to have responsibility for leading and running the entire executive branch. And that's, you know, a substantial responsibility. And regardless of what positions you've held before, whether you're a senator, as Obama was, or you were governor, as George W. Bush was, or Bill Clinton was, you're still, it's a magnitude of difference. And then you have the Trump administration coming in, which is, again, coming in as an outsider administration, one that's coming from the business world, from the private sector. A lot of the folks who are coming in are coming from positions in the private sector, or they're coming from the military. And so they're, you know, sort of, they're learning, or they're going to be learning about how to run the federal bureaucracy, which is one of the largest employers in the world. And that's a lot of information. It's a lot of specificity. It's a lot of sort of a learning curve. And that's, you know, that was anticipated by the framers of the Constitution. And that's also what presidents have said as they come into office, that, you know, when they start sort of learning what they are in charge of, and also how slow the federal government is in terms of a transition, that it's sort of not necessarily anticipated. And so I think part of that, part of what we're seeing is more of the transition discussion, possibly through Twitter, going on, whereas in the past it's been to some degree more of the folks who are coming in, meeting with the folks who are going out. And that's, you know, that's been part of the tradition in the past for a peaceful transition of power, which the United States is famous for.
And it is this, as you were getting at there, kind of this weird no man's land, in that it takes such a slow amount of time, a long time between the election and when the inauguration happens. I mean, what do you think ideally happens in that expanse of time?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of folks in political science who do a lot of work on this and actually help with the transition. They, and a number of my colleagues in Washington, D.C., actually write, you know, briefings, books, and try to meet with and offer their services to incoming folks in the new administration so that they can sort of get an understanding of, like, these are the people who work for you, and this is how this operates, and this is what you have to anticipate. And things may change. You know, policies obviously are going to change, but, you know, there are going to be a bunch of folks in the Department of Agriculture, and there are going to be a bunch of folks at the Department of Energy and the Department of Education, and they're civil servants, and they're going to continue to do the jobs that they were hired to do as part of the federal government. So it's the folks at the top who oftentimes need to learn about, you know, how they manage the particular bureaucracy that they're now being put in charge of.
And Lily, as we start to wrap up, the 115th Congress will be sworn in tomorrow, and,
yep,
and they start hearings for President-elect Trump's cabinet nominees as well. How do you think those hearings are going to go?
Well, again, you know, this is likely to start almost immediately. Mitch McConnell, who's going to be the continuing as the majority leader in the Senate, has said that he'd like to sort of move some of these hearings along quite quickly. And it's likely that we'll start seeing hearings maybe this week or next week for folks like Senator Jeff Sessions, who Trump has nominated to be attorney general, and some of the other folks who he has already indicated. And so I'm expecting that, you know, some of those hearings may not be quick, in that they may go on for a week or so, and that the senators, again, will have their opportunity to ask questions of the nominees.
Lily, thank you so much for joining us again.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on today.
That was Lily Gorin, professor of politics and global studies at Carroll University. She joined us from our Milwaukee studios to look at how the presidential transition is shaping up so far. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.